SRN, your daily commute companion.
Hi, Cameron Wilson joining you for Bush Telegraph on RN and Radio Australia. Well, if you saw the final at the movies ever earlier this week, you would have seen David Stratton declare Charlie's Country one of his top five films of the year. It was actually the only Australian film to make that list. So today, an interview from back in July with the film's director, Rolf de Heer, on how he and David Gulpilil began writing the film while the actor was in jail.
I said to him, David, what are you going to do when you get out? You know, what do you want to do? Because he gave me no answer to what are you going to do when you get out. And I said, what do you want to do? And he said, make a film, make more films. And then he just brightened up a little bit and he said, no, I want to make another film with you.
That's coming up today on Bush Telegraph. Some of the world's biggest companies like Nike and IKEA, are setting stricter environmental demands on their suppliers, basically to improve their public image. Some are arguing that this is actually good news for Australian cotton growers. Like many of the nation's crops in the northeast, cotton has endured a fairly tough year. But even though production's well down, there is an opportunity for the local industry as big cotton producers, as Australia's big cotton producers, I should say, there's an opportunity for them as the users attempt to greenwash their product. Lyndon Mulligan is the chair of Cotton Australia. He's also a cotton grower himself near Moree in the north of New South Wales. Lyndon, thank you for joining Bush Telegraph.
Thanks, Cameron.
How's your crop looking?
Very mixed bag, Cameron. My crop's a little bit slow, so it is, because obviously with the big dry, as in most cotton growers, everything's been a little bit slow. There's been a little bit of rain, a few scattered showers around this past week, which has been very good for us. But, yeah, just a mixed bag right across the whole cotton region.
Yeah, okay. So how the national crop, the nation's crop, how's it compared to last year?
We're looking at probably a reduction, probably about half of last year's crop. Obviously, it's the production's limited to water mainly. And so, yeah, with a drier season, where last year, this past season, is our fourth year of 4 million and above bales, which have been very big years for us. But this year, we're probably looking at about a 2 million bale crop.
Okay. The temptation is to think 50% reduction, that's massive. But would it be fair to say cotton's one of those industries that it does go up and down? The fluctuations are quite large.
That's a pretty good comment, actually, Cameron, and a pretty good statement, because that's basically what happens is, depending on the season, farmers will jump in and out of crops a little bit, depending on where prices are and how the seasons are tracking. So there's always a little bit of room and a little bit of movement there.
Yeah. So what does it mean, though? If you've built up the crop over 3 years to, what did you say, 4 million bales?
4 million bales.
Yeah. So if you've built up to 4 million bales, I take it that means you've found demand for that product. Do you risk losing those markets if all of a sudden you can't meet the demand?
There's certainly challenging for us, Cameron. We build Australian cotton. Cotton's got a great reputation overseas, and that's how we can produce such big crops, sell all our cotton, and then, when we do have a reduction in the crop size, yes, we do risk losing some of those markets. You would certainly not like to see our production drop any lower anyway.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of time, a lot of effort for the industry to build our reputation up, and it's certainly a pity to see us go too much lower.
So cotton's like most of Australia's agriculture, is that it relies on high quality rather than huge quantities?
Yeah, that's pretty true. Australian cotton's got a great reputation overseas because we export most of it, 99.9% of it's exported, so really we have to be listening to what our customers are saying over the season, delivering a product that's very high quality, low in contamination, and be able to ship it over to the customers in time.
What really makes good quality cotton?
Usually it's the colour, so actually the fibre characteristics, and perhaps, not a marketer, but it's the fibre colours usually the biggest factor.
Okay, and how do you get what you want? Is that skills from the grower, or is that climate, a bit of both?
A little bit of both, actually. There's plenty of management in there. A little bit of the weather. Last year we got hit with a little bit of weather towards the end of the season, which did some areas a little bit of damage. But generally speaking, you can overcome a lot of those problems as well.
Mm. Yeah, it's an industry that it's had its share of challenges in terms of its reputation, hasn't it? You're known as big water users, rightly or wrongly. What are the companies doing, the big companies doing, to try to change that reputation?
Do you mean as in the biggest irrigators?
No, I mean the end users of the cotton.
Oh, I think as far as water's concerned, I think you're a farmer first, and then you're an irrigator, and then you make the decisions based on that. So if you think that cotton's growing the greatest, you're giving the greatest return per meg, then you'll grow cotton. If it's something else, then you'll grow some other crop.
Mm.
And most of the time, just cotton seems to be the one that's is the most profitable, so growers and farmers tend to grow cotton more than any other crop.
But if you've got a company like a Nike or an IKEA that say, look, all of a sudden, in the next 5 or 6 years, we want strict environmental standards on our growers, which is what I understand they're saying, how does that help the Australian industry?
Well, I think the Australian industry just released our first sustainability report. We've had three environmental reports for the last one released last year, and the sustainability report's an attempt to give us a snapshot in time and give us some benchmarks about how we might improve the industry. Unless you actually get a benchmark, you actually can't prove that you're actually gaining. And so, you know, a few years' time, we'll have a look and see what we've made gains in. Obviously, in this past few years, we've made great gains in our water usage efficiency and also in our pesticide reduction.
Okay, so a few changes going on in the industry. Good luck with it, Lyndon. Hope the season pans out well for you.
Oh, I'm sure it will. It always does. As a farmer, you've always got to think it's going to come out pretty good.
Otherwise, you'd give up, eh? All right. Thanks, Lyndon. All the best. Lyndon Mulligan, Chair of Cotton Australia, also a cotton grower near Moree. I want to stay with cotton a little longer. If you're a very long-time listener to Bush Telegraph, you might remember something called Grow Your Own. It was a series 12 years ago. Stuart Higgins gave up 5 football fields worth of land on his farm in southeast Queensland for Bush Telegraph listeners to grow their own cotton crop. I'll speak to Stu in a moment, but let's take you back to 2003 first. The presenter of Bush Telly at the time was Alicia Brown, and the show's cotton crop was just about to be harvested for the first time.
That is the sound of the first bowls of Grow Your Own cotton hitting the bin in the back of the picker. Stu, get down off the picker and come and talk to me. Now, you've just picked the first pass of the Grow Your Own crop. How are you feeling? Did you think we'd get this far?
Well, no. On Sunday, really worried that it wasn't going to happen, but we've done an up and a back. And, yeah, it's coming pretty well. The bushes aren't too big, but there's a lot of cotton on there, so it's not very showy, but yeah, it looks good. And this does simulate what it's like farming. When you've picked the crop, you still don't know exactly what you've produced. And I think that's important for people to understand that you've got to pick it. It then gets sent to the gin. The module weights get worked out. The quality is then analysed. And then the farmer finally works out what he's being paid.
Stu Higgins, who, the keeper of our Grow Your Own crop 12 years ago. Well, more than a decade on, Stu. Welcome back to the program.
Yeah, thanks, Cameron. Nice to be here.
What comes to mind when you hear that?
Oh, a lot of fond memories, a lot of challenges, a lot of fun, meeting a lot of new fascinating people from the ABC and working with them.
Mm-hmm.
I was sitting here smiling, listening to it.
It was quite a radical thing to do for a farmer when that first happened. Why'd you get involved?
To be honest, I just finished doing an ethics and leadership course through the St James Ethics Centre called the Vincent Fairfax Ethics and Leadership Course. And through that met someone from the ABC, a lovely person by the name of Kath Dwyer. We got talking, we caught up with Sarah McDonald over a coffee one morning and started throwing around these ideas. And part of that ethics course, part of the principle behind it, or one of the thinkings behind it, is the unexamined life is not worth living. So we sort of thought about it, and the unexamined crop is not worth growing, so we decided to grow a cotton.
Open up your crop and your life for examination, eh?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Well, we did that as well, yes.
Yeah, just take us back a little bit. What sort of input did the listeners have to how you'd go about growing the crop?
Oh, look, they had total control. I would select the challenges, being the activities that the listeners would have to make a decision on, and they would be along the lines of, will we fertilise with organic fertiliser or synthetic fertiliser? Will we plant a genetically modified crop, or would we just plant a conventional crop? Would we irrigate it? Would we not? would we spray for pesticides or not? So basically they were having to make the decisions that a farmer would make,
mm-hmm.
and they would vote via the phone or online, and whichever got the highest percentage, I would go and do that. No questions asked.
No questions. You'd get on with it. I imagine a lot of the people making the decisions would have been city-based, so those decisions might have been based in ideology rather than what was seen as realistic by a farmer. Did that present its own challenges?
Look, it didn't really present challenges. It was a real learning journey, and what we would do each week was I would contact sort of experts or and mainly scientists within the industry, and I would have one scientist explaining the rationale behind going organic, and then one scientist explaining the rationale behind potentially using synthetic, and they would make that decision. So,
mm-hmm.
They had the information in front of them. They were able to decide themselves. And look, what was fascinating during Grow Your Own was, you talk about the idealism. Look, and reflecting back on it, and it was a long time ago, mind you. But yes, started quite idealistic. We went organic. We went non-GM. What we did was we started to think, wow, okay, so this is quite idealistic. What we'll do is we'll add a financial component. So we started to say, well, will you insure the crop for hail or will you not insure it? And people said, we won't insure it. And it was like, wow, okay, farmers normally don't think that way. Farmers normally insure what they make or cover for those sort of disasters. So then we threw in the challenge of, okay, any money that we make off the 5 football fields, we'll donate that to a charity, a rural charity, of the listener's choice. And what was fascinating, and I don't have the numbers, obviously, in my head, it's been quite a while, but it flipped overnight. So people were starting to say, right, we need to now spray for insects because we want to help the bush kids.
Because they've got a stake in it all
exactly,
of a sudden.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was a really interesting an interesting outcome.
So we, over the last few weeks, we've been talking a lot about this program's role in bridging that divide between city and country. Ultimately, what do you think was achieved by the project?
Oh, look, I think we did have a really good go at bridging that divide. I must say that divide goes both ways. So, and that's one thing I took away from Grow Your Own is quite often farmers or rural people are thinking we need to educate the city on how it's done, and that is completely true. But what we also need to understand is the city are the consumers, and we need to understand what they're looking for.
Mm.
And I caught the last of the discussion with Lyndon about the IKEAs of the world. So that it really entered that space where it was truly a two-way interaction.
So what, IKEA is catching up with the Bush Telegraph audience, is it?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
So did it ultimately, though? I know you haven't got the numbers in front of you, but was it a success? In a farming sense, I mean, not an exercise in building relations between city and country, but in a farming sense.
No, well, I have to say it's been my, and I say this with a smile on my face, it's been my greatest failure to date. I sort of live by the mantra, I think Winston Churchill thought it up, that success in life is going from one failure to the next without diminishing enthusiasm. And if you look at what we tried to achieve right at the end with Grey Rain, we produced, I think it was 13 bales of cotton. And what we tried to do was get a premium for that cotton because it was grown more environmentally, it had a story behind it, and consumers could connect to it. Unfortunately, we were unable to get that premium because of the fact that cotton is a very, it's a globally traded commodity. It didn't really have a niche market at the time. So on that part, it was a failure. But the great success was the conversation and the thinking and the amount of thought and energy that everyone put into it.
Sounds like it was before its time. These are things we talk about all the time now.
Oh, look, and that's correct. It certainly, I think it highlights that things take a very long time to evolve, and adoption of ideas and adoption of practices take a very, very long time. 5 years is nothing, 13, 12 years is nothing. You're probably looking at 30 or 40 years, and I think that's we didn't change the world, but we had a bit of fun sort of changing maybe a fraction of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now I know you're out of cotton these days. I hope it wasn't the Bush Telegraph listeners that sent you under.
No, certainly not. To be honest, they kept me going at the time. I think I can remember back, it was 2002. I think it might have been one of the second worst droughts in the history.
Yeah, that was
the
thick of it then, wasn't it?
Yeah, white Australia. Yeah. So at the time, for my own sort of well-being, it was probably the perfect distraction. I mean, it drove me crazy at the time. It was really frustrating, but that was all fantastic distraction from watching, you know, the other parts of your farm not doing so well.
Yeah, they're demanding Radio National listeners, aren't they? Hey? Get involved.
They're intelligent. I'll give them that.
Yeah, good letter writers too, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah.
So you're still involved in ag now. How do you think that the industry has changed since then, if you look at what's happening now and what you went through back then?
Well, I've sort of shifted. I'm certainly very much still involved in agriculture. I've shifted out of probably Australian agriculture a lot. I now do, and at the time of Grow Your Own, I'm in international agricultural development. So I'm mainly working overseas these days, or actually I don't work much at all in Australia now. But and I work with smallholder farmers and work with organisations like ACR, the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research.
Yep.
So look, one of the fascinating things, or the things I'm really grateful for about being a farmer, was a lot of the work I'm doing now is working with farmers and trying to understand farmers and understand how they think. And having been one myself, although, you know, we face significantly different challenges, you know, a Western type farmer or a developed type farmer versus a non-developed country farmer, we still have similar thought processes, and that's been a real advantage for what I'm doing now.
Yeah, great. So you've moved into another area of particular interest to this program, and that's, I guess, how we develop agriculture around the world, help feed the world. Interesting stuff. All the best with it. Thanks for the updates, Stu.
Yeah, thanks very much, Cameron. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. I'm going to keep that Winston Churchill quote in mind. It might come in handy.
Yeah, it's a good one.
All right, all the best.
All right, bye.
So that's Stu, who was our Grow Your Own farmer. How long ago was that? 12 years ago now, which is incredible, isn't it? Stuart Higgins there, who's now spends a lot of his time overseas. Let's get the latest today in rural news now. You're listening to RN Bush Telegraph. Okay, so one definition of madness might be having six kids over a 20-year period. We will be meeting a woman on a farm with six kids of her own very soon. Oldest is 23, youngest is 3, and she's going to tell us how she keeps the kids safe living on one of the most dangerous workplaces in Australia. This might be a particular interest for anyone who over the Christmas break might be having the kids on the farm a bit more than usual, or visiting those relatives from the country if you normally live in the city. So stay with us for that. But we better get the latest in rural news from Tony Allen first today. Tony, really sad story about the death of a young child it's linked to consuming raw milk. I know there's still some questions around there, but it's really kicked off this debate again around pasteurised milk.
Yes, milk is sold as bathing milk if it's raw or unpasteurised. It is illegal to sell it direct to the public for health reasons, but often it's in a very similar shaped bottle. And a 3-year-old child has died in Victoria after allegedly drinking unpasteurised milk from a dairy in Gippsland, and several other children have been also admitted to hospital or got sick from drinking raw milk, as it's called. Now, the health authorities are issuing warnings about the dangers of drinking unpasteurised milk because the pasteurisation process briefly heats the milk to a temperature that kills any dangerous bacteria. Helen Dornham from Dairy Australia says one thing that should be done is that the packaging should be distinctly different. At the moment, bathing milk really looks like real milk, and people treat it like real milk. A lot of people still drink it, even though you're not supposed to, and they make cheese out of it and stuff like that. Not many people bath in it, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
Helen Dornham from Dairy Australia says some people choose to ignore the warnings on the bottle about the health risks, but others may simply be confused because of the packaging.
So in this case, it is labelled not for human consumption. You can mount an argument to say that if it looks like the same product that is for human consumption, there could well be some confusion. To the extent we can remove that confusion, we would support that fully.
Okay, so this debate, which has really been heightened by that tragic incident, the death of a young child. It comes while there's a food standards review into our raw milk products in Australia as well.
There are lots of interesting issues, which I haven't got time to go into, but one of them, for example, is how can the health authorities recall a product that wasn't put out as a food in the first place?
Yeah, okay, if it's used against the guidelines on the label. Yeah, okay, interesting element to it as well. Yesterday on the program we looked at SCAS, which is basically the system that keeps track of live animal exports from Australia to overseas markets. ABC Rural had done an analysis of the breaches of the SCAS standards. I see the Agriculture Minister, the Federal Agriculture Minister, has weighed in.
Yes, we did ask Barnaby Joyce about the Exporter Supply Chain Assurance Scheme, which is being reviewed, but so far we don't have the results of that review. He does say that he has threatened to shut down some live animal exporters for breaches of SCAS. He won't say which companies are the worst offenders, but he does say he's been indulging in what he calls fireside chats with them.
Believe you me, I've had one-on-one come-to-the-fireplace chats with livestock exporters, letting them know quite clearly. And I have had conversations with them saying, look, if you don't pull your socks up in this area, we'll just shut you down. No one on the land wants the barbarous treatment of animals, but we need this trade.
Okay, so we'll hear more about that, no doubt. What should we finish with? What about the CWA? They're in the news again today and talking drought. This has become core business for the CWA recent years.
A bit of good news. The New South Wales Country Women's Association has donated $100,000 to the Rural Counselling Service to be distributed to drought-stricken farmers in New South Wales as a Christmas gift. There'll be supermarket gift cards, fuel cards and cash. President Tanya Cameron says it's the second Drought Assistance Association donation the association has made to farmers this year.
Hopefully at this time of the year it will actually prove to be a little bit of a bonus where there might not have been money otherwise to splash out on Christmas festivities as such, not necessarily presents, but just feeling festive. People are living on their equity. They're going through that equity, trying to get through this drought.
Hmm. And just incidentally, Mr. Joyce has confirmed that he has warned banks not to foreclose on farmers.
Given them a warning.
Given them a warning, although the opposition says it's just his way of deflecting onto banks what was a failed drought package.
Okay.
So it's still politics.
There's the politics
in that.
Of it. Yeah. All right. Let's leave it there. Thanks a lot, Tony. Tony Allen with today's Rural News. You're listening to Bush Telegraph, RN and Radio Australia.
A veteran of over 100 films, you could never accuse Isabelle Huppert of phoning it in. Now she plays a cattle farmer who sneaks off to Paris and has an affair in the new film Folie Bergère.
She's a free spirit, in a way. She has no sense of morality.
I love that. There's not a lot of guilt in this film, which I like.
Which I like that too, very much. No guilt. She does it.
Isabelle Huppert with me, Jason DeRosso, on The Final Cut, tonight at 9:45.
Still to come on the program, we'll revisit an interview with Rolf Dahir that was, we had Rolf Dahir on the program back in July, and it was about then the upcoming movie Charlie's Country, the upcoming release of the movie Charlie's Country, a Australian film starring David Gulpilil that was rated by David Stratton this week on the final at the movies as one of the best five releases of the year. So we'll revisit that very soon. First though, if you're a miner or a factory worker, you wouldn't dream of taking your kids to work over the 6 weeks period of Christmas holidays. But if you're a farming family, it's a very different reality. The fact is that children will be living and helping out on what is rated as one of Australia's most hazardous workplaces. So while growing up on a farm can provide plenty of freedom, there's a lot of good about it, freedom and space, it also means that the kids are exposed to a variety of hazards that are not experienced by other youngsters. Experts are reminding us this summer to be mindful of the risks of having kids on the farm, whether they're your own or whether they're visiting from the city. Chairman of the Primary Industries Health and Safety Partnership is Gordon Gregory, who's urging farming families to play it safe these holidays. Gordon, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Cameron.
What do the stats say about the dangers of kids on farms?
Well, look, too many are killed. I mean, wouldn't it be lovely if through this summer and celebratory period that we're just going into, if we could have no children killed or indeed injured on farms. Two-thirds of children killed on farms are under 5 years of age, so clearly this is something where you know, parents and carers are responsible. And I guess the purpose is just to remind people, as we all break for the summer, to do the necessary things to take care.
Yeah, so the young kids particularly at risk. Is there? Do you have any stats or a sense of whether there's city kids visiting farms that are at greater risk than, say, the farm kids that live there?
I don't have the figures, but I mean, intuitively, you would say that those kids who are not familiar with the risks, you know, are at greater danger. But I say again, it really is a time for us to be celebrating the wonderful things that happen during holidays, but to remember always the exposure of young people who don't have all the natural abilities to take care of themselves. So we really need to be caring for the kids on the farms in all ways, that is through information, through instruction, through setting boundaries, through physical barriers. In other words, you know, water risks need to be fenced off and so on and so forth. So we all know what needs to be done, and really the purpose of this this highlighting is just to remind people that, you know, it can happen to them even with the best will in the world, so people need to be really, really caring and careful.
Keep it front of mind, yeah. Ainsley MacArthur knows a thing or two about this. Ainsley's a mother of six kids and lives on a beef grazing property in central Queensland. Hi, Ainsley.
Hi, Cameron.
What do you teach the kids to try to keep them safe?
Our children are, I was going to say, born and bred here, so I guess safety is something that we're aware of every day, and it starts for us. It's, you know, it starts with them, you know, having boots and long sleeve shirts and hats and jeans and all those good things that our city cousins would do as well. You know, the sun safe sort of a message, and then.
But do they just develop an instinct for what's dangerous and what's not on the farm?
I think, but and discussion, and I guess. For us, we're talking to the kids all the time about the dangers as we're working, leading by example. You know, they wouldn't get on their horse without a helmet on. They wouldn't dream of, you know, going into the yards without their boots on. You know, snake awareness. You know, we've got creeks and whatever, but by nature and I guess by example. They know that, you know, if the creek's flooding or running, you know, what to look out for. I really feel here my heightened awareness of safety occurs when we have our have visitors who don't have that innate feeling of the dangers, Kevin.
Really? You sense that difference, do you, that your kids might know when to take a bit more caution than... Maybe the visitors don't have that same sense.
And also, you know, that peer awareness. Particularly around things like vehicles and obviously our kids have had the opportunity to learn to drive, but if I had a visiting family, I wouldn't probably let them drive, you know, because of that peer pressure.
So what, your little one, your quite young ones will drive, will they? On the farm, I imagine they
would. Yeah. I was going to say, apart from our three-year-old, obviously she's not driving.
Not yet.
No. The five-year-old's in the throes of just learning to steer and, you know, sit on Dad's knee down to the mailbox and whatever.
They're all learning. Yeah, that was my first experience with a grandfather's ute on the farm. It just goes part of it, isn't it, when you spend time growing up?
I know my sister often says that, you know, particularly as the kids get older and one of the biggest killers, and obviously I don't have stats on it, but one of the, you know, the classic 18 to sort of 25-year-old age group and, you know, high-powered motor vehicles, we often talk around the table and say that... kids that growing up at a younger age probably are fortunate to get an awareness of the dangers and the feel for speed and what the implications of that may be.
Yeah. Well, look, Ainsley, keep the family safe and the visitors safe over the Christmas break, and have a good Christmas and a new year. Thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
No worries, Cameron.
Ainsley MacArthur, who's got six kids, lives on a beef grazing property in central Queensland. My thanks also to Gordon Gregory, the Chief Executive Officer of the Rural Health Alliance. Something to keep in mind, isn't it, that yes, a lot of us will have family members on a agricultural property, on a farm, essentially, that might get a visit at this time of year over the Christmas break. So just remember, it's not the safest place for kids. A lot of good that they can, a lot of things to enjoy for them there, but also some dangers as well. You're listening to Bush Telegraph, RN and Radio Australia. I'm Cameron Wilson. Let's revisit a story from earlier in the year. Ever since David Gulpilu was on our screens as a 16-year-old in the 1971 film Walkabout, he's had a particular presence in Australian cinema. But we also know that his life's not been an easy one. It's been punctuated by alcohol use, and there was also a recent stint in jail. His most recent performance, In Charlie's Country, was released earlier this year and was named earlier in the week as one of the best releases of 2014 by David Stratton. It won David Gulpilu a Best Actor Award at this year's Cannes Film Festival. It's also been held up as a redemptive process for both him and the character that he portrays. So, to talk about the journey, I was joined earlier in the year by the director of Charlie's Country, Rolf De Heer.
Thank you, Cameron. Yes, nice to be here.
Can I take you back to when you travelled from your home in Tasmania to Darwin to meet with your friend, really, isn't he? Friend and collaborator,
yeah.
David Gulpilu.
Yeah, yeah.
David was in jail at the time, so how distant was the prospect that he would win Best Actor Award at the Cannes Film Festival for the film you hadn't yet made?
I liken it to a fairy story in that way. It was completely distant. When I saw him in jail that first morning, all the life had gone out of him. You know, he's one of the most lively people I know. He's got the sparkle better than almost anybody I know. But it was not there. And I knew that he had abused his brain severely in the months and the year or so leading up to his incarceration. And I wondered if he still could do it at all. Not that I came there thinking that that's what we were going to do, but I thought about what to do, and I thought, well, what can I do? I can't do anything apart from, you know, the only thing I can do to help him is perhaps make a film with him, but I don't know if he wants to. And so, you know, at the end of that hour, which was a difficult time because it just was bad conversation that was not going anywhere, I said to him, David, what are you going to do when you get out, you know? What do you want to do? Because he gave me no answer to what are you going to do when you get out. And I said, what do you want to do? And he said, you know, make a film, you know, make more films. And then he just brightened up a little bit and he said, no, I want to make another film with you. Well, the first thing I then have to think about what to do, and thinking about exactly what you're saying about how distant it was to get to the point that we got to. I mean, my first thought was, yes, well, how are we going to do that?
Did you think you would at that point?
I think at that moment I knew I had to try because I could see nothing but destruction ahead for David and unless something came into the proceedings, unless he had some reason to change his behaviours, something to look forward to that precluded him from just going on the same spiral as he'd been on beforehand. I thought of Namajira and I thought, yeah, what's going to, you know, look. So I went back to the hotel room and I began to think about what to do, and it really was for me risk management strategy. You know, how do we do something with somebody who of such originally talent, but you know who perhaps can't even do it anymore? How can we make a film with him? And you know, I sort of thought about it and I thought, yeah, okay, we do this, we put stuff in it that he's familiar with and then he can more easily create the character and perhaps, you know, just bring out moments of just flashes of his original brilliance and, you know, we'll manage something. And so it becomes contemporary and, you know, it forced all these things onto the film that are ultimately in the film. And, of course, David, the second time I saw him, and which was the next day, and I said, look, okay, we're going to give it a try, already began to brighten, and I realised afterwards that what I had seen that first day was depression. That's all it was. Now, he has given his brain a fearful beating. I've just got off the phone to him just now, and he said, you know, somebody wanted to interview him, and he wanted me to tell him not to interview him anymore because he's got brain damage. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to be interviewed right now, but he recognises, you know, that he has given his brain a fearful beating. But despite that, I can still categorically say he's a genius as an actor, and he was a genius as an actor on set, and he created a performance that, you know, it's the best he's been.
He was he was in jail. Obviously, he was in a very bad way beforehand. He was in jail for assaulting his partner while they were both drunk. How important was it to you that David had a project in the pipeline while he was in jail?
Well, it was not the reason I went to see him in the first place. I just went because I thought I had to. I didn't even think about why. I thought, I've got to go and see him.
Just instinctive, was it?
Just to go and see him. Mm. Just to say, look, here I am, and I support you as a human being in some way. Thinking about it after having seen him that first time, I thought, look, you know, this could work if he's capable, because it will do a lot. It will give him something to look forward to while he's in prison. You know, some reason for carrying on better. It will allow him some sort of transition to a more normal life. It will or may allow him that. It will give him the prospect of some sort of income. That's always important to him. And so there were many reasons why I thought, you know, that this was apart from anything else, it was the only thing I could do. I mean, I can't go up there and live his life for him or look after his money or sign his paperwork or tell him what to do and what not to do, you know. Mm. And that's what it would, you know, that would be a one-way road to heartbreak to try and do that. Mm. And so in the end, I thought, yeah, well, it's all I can do, and let's give it a go.
So once you'd had those initial meetings and you'd both decided you were going to do this, what themes were you, between the two of you, what themes were you intent on exploring?
When whether I'm doing it in collaboration with someone or not, I suppose, but when I'm creating a project, and that process was creating the project, I steer clear of articulating anything to do with theme or thinking about it in any sort of intellectual way, because what I tend to do if I do that is I tend to contrive in a way that doesn't work. Okay, so the way we did things was even on that second morning, you know, I said, David, let's give it a go. Mm. Can't guarantee it. We've got to get it financed, blah, blah, blah. He started to talk to me in a much more lively way than the previous day, but about random about stuff that was apparently random, but knowing David well enough, I knew was not. What he was doing was he was presenting me with possibilities, and I brought my pencil and bits of paper along. And I began to make notes, and would have been very much what he would have expected of me. And neither of us talked about that this is what we were doing, but this is what we did. And through that process, I began to learn what sort of film David wanted to make. And it coincided very much with the sort of film I wanted to make, or I thought we could make, more importantly. And it developed in that way. David wanted it to have meaning, and so did I, because that's just the best way to do something, is you give it real meaning, and then you get passionate about it, and it can be a great film. And if it's a great film, it has a chance. So, I mean, look, at one point David said, you know, this film is about me. It's about me. It's my film. And, you know, I don't want to make autobiographical piece. I don't want it to be about David Gulpel, the actor. Mm. But also, again, I know David well enough to try and tease out what he means by that. And so we had a bit of a discussion about that, you know. And me articulating it for him, what he meant was, I want this film to be authentic to my experience.
Mm. And hence it was set in David's own community of Rumiginning, yeah, and has the reference to Dancing for the Queen at the opening of the Sydney Opera House. So there are...
Now, they are experiences. I mean, look, that was as much me as anything else, making sure that the stuff that went into it was stuff that David could access and could think about and knew of in some way. I mean, he talks about the Queen a lot. Mm. And he talks about going to Buckingham Palace and all of that sort of stuff. And so that's got to go in it, because it's, you know, and then how do you use it? And, you know, we find ways to use it.
For me, that was almost the paradox in the film. It was constantly talking about connection to country and preserving culture, and yet references to the Queen kept coming back in.
And there are a number of the men of David's age up in Rumiginning who do that. You know, they talk about, if it's not the Queen, it's about some great experience that they've had, well, that they perceive as being great, meeting some famous person at some stage, or and I think it's a self-esteem reminder to themselves. Mm. So, because, you know, for a long time, they've been told their culture is going to disappear and it's no good. And so they find these odd things that they repeat quite a lot, which, as if to remind themselves that they have some value, whether it be in their cultural terms or not, because it's not how they think.
I'm chatting here with Rolf de Heer, who is the director of Charlie's Country. It's released on the 17th of July. It stars David Goldberg. Rolf, how difficult is it actually to go about making a film, not just in a remote part of Australia, a remote country, but with a cast of largely untrained actors?
I'd had, a fair bit of practice.
Yeah, in some ways I'm surprised you went back with some of the things I'd read.
Look, you know, I had no intention of going back. it's one of those things that happen. of course it's not easy. But I've learned to give over in a different way than I make those films. Those two films have been made differently to other films that I've made. This one was hard. It was very hard. I mean, I worked out that, you know, David is under such pressure from people within his community because of who he is and what he's perceived to have and that he doesn't have. And he's under such pressure that, in fact, Rumiginning is the hardest place in the world to make a film with David Goldberg. And the second hardest place in the world to make a film with David Goldberg is Darwin. And they're the two places we shot. I completely misunderstood that at the beginning. Although I don't know that I would have done it any differently. But it would have prepared me better for the degree of difficulty that it had. But when David is, when the camera's rolling and David's in front of it and he knows what to do, you just forget about all that because it's magic.
some of the most enjoyable parts in the film are when Charlie's chatting with some of the other elders on the country, and some of the dialogue is extremely funny.
Yeah.
Is that written or is that...
To greater or lesser extent, it is. Mm. I try to leave it open, but very often that was not what was wanted. Look, non-actors are improvising. Mingalulu, to improvise, very difficult for him. Mm. Much easier that we shoot in little grabs and he knows pretty closely what he's got to say. Jigger is a bit different. He can drive something, but he's very easy with dialogue anyway, and if there's something specific that's better for him, then he'll go that way.
Mingalulu being Peter Mingalulu, who, from if memory serves, was part of 10 canoes and then not part of 10 canoes and then came back again.
Exactly correct. And, and that was the surprise, that he came back for seconds. You know, I thought there was no way I thought he would be in the film. But when I went after speaking with David first after the jail stuff, and then next place I went to was Raymond Ginning to talk to Jigger in particular, and you know, quite quickly I learnt that Mingaluli was very much up for having another go at it.
Mm.
And he was actually very good, you know. He'd learned, you know. Don't underestimate people learning how to act. I mean, he's very good. He's lovely in the film.
But what else does he bring? Because he's a traditional Yolngu man.
He's very traditional, yes.
So I imagine he brings a lot of that knowledge that you would struggle to get into the film otherwise, if he wasn't there.
He was there at all times on set. He speaks English, just a smattering of it, you know, and it's a funny thing because I love the man and we get on famously, but there's barely a word exchanged between us.
Maybe that's why you get on.
Oh, maybe so. But the really amusing thing was that he hung out with James Curry in the sound, under the sound tent thing, with headphones on constantly, monitoring every word that was said in the dialogue, and shaking his head if he didn't think it was very good, and being very happy if it came out in a way that he felt was correct. And so he was he was the chief cultural advisor with Peter Jigger, just to make sure we got everything right. But working with them, you get that stuff out. You know, it's David is good with it, and so David's not going to do anything that's completely wrong for the film culturally.
But it must help you to feel that you're doing justice that needs to be done when you're exploring ideas like connection to country and preserving culture.
I feel very comfortable because I'm surrounded by such great thinkers about this stuff. I feel very comfortable that I'm not going to be allowed to go wrong. And I mean, look, you know, if you're talking about connection to country, I mean, David was in the lead up to pre-production, showed me really what that was in the most extraordinary way for me when we went back to his traditional land that he hadn't been to for eight years or so, and he just ran around showing me this and showing me that and where he was born and the tree, and you know, it was just this joyous reconnection with his traditional land that is something we've grown so far away from, and it was so strong. I thought, I've never, ever, ever seen anything like this before in my life, and now I understand it.
Even despite your previous filmmaking experience?
Yeah. I mean, when his whole birth story, when he tells that to me, and all the rocks that were part of that, and when I say his birth story, you know what I mean, when he was born and what happened and where he was carried and this happened then and this happened then, and you think we've lost all that, and he still has it.
Mm. I'm chatting here with Rolf Dahir on Bush Telegraph on RN, the director of Charlie's Country. It's released very soon, the 17th of July. Rolf, how political do you think this film is?
On the surface, in some ways, not at all, but in other ways, yes, very much so. Look, how political is it? It depends on the viewer, really. I mean, that's a smart-ass way to say it, but I think it can be watched as a story of a person who does this and this happens and that happens. I think it can also make a small contribution to a debate that we need to keep having. How are we going to improve the condition of the people who are here before we were? How and when are we going to properly unskew the constitution to the extent that it's been skewed?
You'd struggle, any viewer I would suggest would struggle to watch the movie and not see or perceive that there was an element of disempowerment that has gone on with the intervention, or at least not believe that was part of the story being told in this movie.
Yes, but I guess what I mean is if you don't know about the intervention, it's not important. Like the screening at Cannes, most people didn't know about the intervention, and the film works completely well, and it works completely well for people who don't think about the notion of disempowerment, who follow it as something that is really interesting and beautiful in a way. But I think I'm talking myself into a corner here with it, because I think I'm probably on your side with this.
I just wonder if for some people might watch it and maybe it could be a divisive film for some people.
Oh, that's an interesting viewpoint. I hadn't thought of that, and well, maybe it is. Maybe it could be. Look, okay. On the tracker, I remember very clearly being outside a screening in Port Lincoln, and people coming out, and me being spat at. Okay, now you can suggest then that it's a divisive film, and maybe it is, but by far the great majority of people, black or white, went with that film for what it was intended to be. So films that have a bit of the politics in them, or even quite a lot of the politics in them, which is, I guess the tracker has a lot of politics in it in a way, are necessarily, I guess, going to divide to some extent, because people have their viewpoints and some people are not going to be shifted in the short term. And so that's, well, maybe, but I don't think it's going to be that divisive.
Yeah. Just before I let you go, Rolf, when once it became evident that this this film was getting recognition and David's role was being recognised internationally for as successful, at least in critics' eyes, how did the Aboriginal people who were involved in its making, how did they react to the reaction to the film?
We had Jigger with us in Cannes, and he was obviously utterly pleased and delighted and on the phone and passing it on.
Okay, so he was there, but David was not?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes. David was going to come, but he withdrew a couple of weeks beforehand because it was going to clash with some land management meetings that he had an interest in that involved his land as well. So, and I thought that was...
So he made that choice.
He made the choice, yes, and I thought it was fantastic.
Would he have made that choice? Do you believe he would have made that choice earlier in his life?
No. It would have been off to Cannes beyond everything. and, you know, look, much as I would have loved him to have been there, and much as I would love him to be promoting this film now, I think it's a great deal better thing that he's doing that he's not. It shows a shift and some sort of emergence from a way of thinking that hasn't worked for him.
So Jigger was there with you at
Jigger was there.
Got on the phone back to Ramanginning.
Straight bang, Ramanginning, Darwin, everybody he knew. The response has been very good, of course. The response to the film in the first place was great, because we screened it there before anywhere. Just to get a sense that, you know, there was nothing in it left that needed to be changed or fixed. And, of course, there's now tremendous interest. And this, when's the Darwin screening? When's Darwin? So very good. They're all, look, it's cultural validation. It's that's really important to the people there.
What about David's reaction to David, his personal recognition?
Took me 5 days to get onto him. Ring and no answer, ring, no answer, and he'd gone bush. So eventually I got onto him and he hadn't heard. And he was excited to the point of tears of joy. So he wept tears of joy.
Validation for him as well.
Yeah. Well, it was more he had full recognition in his own mind that this film had saved his life. And I said, no, David, you saved your life. You're the one who stopped drinking. No, no, you saved my life. No, 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 you did. And it, and he did. He did all the hard work, and he hasn't had a drink since. And that's, I think, where he found the most joy in that moment.
Well, congratulations on it. We haven't even discussed how beautifully shot it is because the images are just stunning. So congratulations on it, and thank you so much for coming in and being generous with your time. Appreciate it.
And thank you, Cameron.
Rolf De Heer, who's the director of Charlie's Country, that interview recorded earlier this year on Bush Telegraph. Well, that's the program for today. Stay on RN. We've got news for you next. That'll be followed by The World Today. I'll see you at the same time tomorrow. You're on RN.